History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and take the time to patiently listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, it just so happens that we're educated, we're entertained, and really we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The 99-year-old you're going to hear from today, Ralph Graham, lives in Waco, Texas. Just within the last year, he has published a book called 12 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Ghost Plane at the Battle of the Bulge. You're going to hear about why the book carries that title, but this interview was not recorded in the Lone Star State. In Atwater, California, rather, at Castle Air Museum, home to dozens of historic aircraft like the B-17 Flying Fortress, the kind of bomber Ralph flew 33 missions in during World War II. But Ralph Graham has a deeper connection to Castle Air Museum. His connection is to the mission that earned the museum's namesake, our nation's highest military honor. And to put that in perspective for us, we're going to hear first from the executive director of Castle Air Museum, Joe Pruzzo. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can see this 99-year-old Army Air Corps veteran, Ralph Graham, hitting the opening tee shot for Castle Air Museum's annual golf tournament. Ralph and his family foursome fared very well in that tournament, but the history he represents tells a much bigger story. So let's allow Joe Pruzzo to shed some light on that before we hear from Mr. Graham.
Well, first off, it was a great honor and privilege to meet someone from the greatest generation that took part in the battle high above the skies of the Battle of the Bulge, certainly one of the most significant engagements of World War II. What's even more impressive is his connection to the museum's namesake, the former Air Force base's namesake, General Frederick Walker Castle, and knowing that he was in a formation of 2,000 B-17 Flying Fortresses that were being commanded by General Castle is really a significant, to us, a milestone. Talk about coming full circle. Many of your listeners may or may not know General Castle on that mission was flying a brand new airplane in the lead position. He had an engine failure. He had to drop to the back of the formation. And when he did that, he became an easy prey for Luftwaffe fighters. And he ultimately, rather than drop bombs over friendly troops, he and his pilot ultimately gave the supreme sacrifice and let the crew bail out before General Castle and his pilot could bail out. The airplane exploded. We actually have parts of that airplane here in our museum that we exhibit in the indoor exhibit, along with his memorabilia and uniform and Medal of Honor. It's our mission and ultimately goal to teach and educate people coming through the museum on the importance of General Castle and his sacrifices and men like him and those who served under him, and how important their position in history is in preserving the free will of our nation, our freedoms, and those of our allies. I would say there were thousands of people that served at Merced Army Airfield when it was first here, and then it was changed to Castle Air Force Base, I believe, in late 1946 in honor of the General Castle. Unfortunately, these are the things that aren't taught in history classes in school today. So it's up to museums like Castle Air Museum to teach young people and the people coming through on their sacrifices and the importance of air power.
And so you got to see Ralph Graham's golf swing. He hit the first tee shot for your golf tournament, and he also had his book. You have any of those books left?
Yes. We have a couple. We're going to be reordering some. It's called 12 Minutes, and what that signifies is Ralph Graham's airplane was also a new airplane, but they had a mechanical failure. So they went and got a broken-in or war-weary B-17. And in order to transfer gear and equipment, it took 12 minutes. So they were 12 minutes late in catching up with the formation. So that 12 minutes was pretty critical in the scheme of things. They actually bombed with another squadron that they weren't attached to, but ordered by General Castle to join up with any squadron they could. If you get a chance, get it and read it, because it's a very gripping story. It's something, and when I first picked it up, I couldn't put it down. I wanted to read more. To have someone that, within memory, not in a history book, was there on that particular day in that mission, Christmas Eve, 1944, I'm in awe at. I didn't read about this. I actually talked to a living person who was there. He doesn't look a day over 80, Paul. I wonder what his secret is. You know, maybe it's that golf swing. I don't know. But his mental capacities, as sharp as a tack, and just a wonderful, warm gentleman that so typified that generation, the greatest generation. And unfortunately, there aren't a lot of them around anymore to pass on those stories. And, you know, the lessons learned, the lessons of World War II and the lessons of any conflict should never be forgotten. Because if they are, some point when generations forget, we'll repeat them. And we shouldn't allow ourselves to do that.
Which is exactly why this program exists. And with that, let's welcome in 99-year-old Ralph Graham of Waco, Texas, originally from Athens, Texas. Where is that, Ralph, for those of us who don't know? And what do you remember about your childhood there?
Athens is about 75 miles southeast of Dallas. And what I remember more about my childhood was, what we lived on a farm. My father raised cotton and corn and, you know, and everything you could think about. And he taught me how to plow. And I remember when I was 9 years old, and he finally turned it over to me, a plow, and by myself with a Georgia stock and one horse pulling it. And I he'd let me plow out the meadows, you know, and all of that. And it went on from that until I grew up, and then I got to hating it.
It's exciting for a while. Right,
but we did a lot of work, and he was a wonderful farmer. He grew everything. He, you know, we'd have everything. During the Depression, we had everything he'd raised. We even had a peach orchard. And I remember during all those hard times that people would come there to get milk and peaches and potatoes and Irish potatoes and canned meat. What he just give it. We had so much of it, and he didn't want people to suffer, so he would just give it away.
Wow.
And that was our neighbors, you know, had nothing but a house to live in. It's pretty rough times, you know. And, of course, I remember starting to school, and I remember we had sometimes had to walk 2 miles or three to get to school. That before we had buses, you know, to pick us up. That was as I grew up in the, you know, ready for high school,
mm-hmm.
5, 6, 7 years. And finally, I graduated as a ninth grader, you know, and they sent me on to high school. And we only had 3 grades then. It had 9th, 10th, and 11th. That was it. You didn't go to the 12th. I remember all that, and then all the associates, you know, and my classmates.
Do you remember as a boy having some ambition of, hey, when I grow up someday, this is what I'm going to do with my life?
Well, I knew I wanted to do something. But I didn't, you know, at that time, you know, there wasn't much, there wasn't much future to look to, because it was hard, it was bad, you know, during the Depression. But I did want to, I really wanted to be an engineer. But when we enlisted, they asked you what you wanted to do, and I told them, you know, I'd like to be in that part where we built bridges and things like that. And that's where they put me, and that's where I served for about 16 months, all my time there. From that, there was a bulletin that came out that if you'd like to try out as an aviation cadet, you can go down and take the test. And I did, and I barely passed. But anyway, a classmate and mine went down, and we tried, and both of us did.
So tell me about, though, December 7th. Where were you, and how did you find out what happened?
December 7th, I was, of course, still in the engineers, and we was walking down the street, been down to the recreation room, and we got back up to the door where you go in the barracks, and somebody hollered out, says, the Japanese have hit Pearl Harbor. Well, I didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was, you know. I hadn't been in the Army, you know, that long enough to know that. But anyway, that was my first time I knew that was in war.
And where was that? Where were you?
That was in San Antonio, with the 2nd Infantry Division, and the 2nd Engineers was part of it.
You know? Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's where I was. We came up from boot camp up to it.
And did you see things changing a lot after Pearl Harbor?
Oh, you bet. I think we were about 350,000 people in the services then, and we watched it grow and just tumble. There's just thousands after thousands that came in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason they wanted to pick out somebody that had, I did have a high school education, you know, had to do that to qualify to train. Well, anyway, I trained for, went through primary and then basic.
You're thinking you're going to be a pilot.
I learned to fly.
Mm-hmm.
But something happened. It really happened in primary. I felt something, you know, in doing aerobatics like spins and loops and all that, where the strain was on you. I felt pressure in my lower part of my body. Well, I made it all right in that plane, but when I went to basic, well, when we went from 165 horsepower to 450.
Was that from a Stearman to a BT-13 or something?
That's what it was. Yeah. The old Vultee vibrator, they called it.
So it's a big difference in power.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that showed up bad. So I went to the doctor and told him I was having trouble. He said, well, the only thing he could do was really operate. So I went back and I tried again, you know, to see if I could make it through. And I blacked out. And I went on back and told him, let's operate. I wanted to finish so bad. I said, go ahead and operate. And he did, but it didn't help. You can't fly a plane with that, you know. So I told him I didn't want to go on paperwork until that cured out. I wanted to go on. So they sent me on to radio school.
How disappointing was that for you at the time?
It was bad, because I wanted to be an officer, you know.
Yeah.
But that was all right. You know, I didn't want somebody to give me something. So I went on to radio school, finished that, and then the gunnery school, finished that, and they put a cruiser up. We went through, you know, the basic part of a team working together. Of course, from there in, it was up through the northern part. We flew over and carried bomb bay full of GI mail. We left one night about sundown and got about halfway, and they turned us back on account of that weather closed in Iceland. So we came back and waited a few days longer, and it cleared up, and this time we made it. A bunch of kids.
I was going to say, was that a little nerve-wracking for you? You'd never been through anything like that before.
Flying across, you know, 1,500 miles of water. Well, the pilot did kind of, he became a little worried every once in a while. He said, call the navigator and say, how we doing? Well, we're on course. That's about all he knew. And I did. I called him once and told him the radio traffic was sounding louder, you know, and he said, that's some relief. And so, of course, we finally, it was, navigator was right. We went right on money. That was really the last part of the war, because we didn't go over till October of 1944. And all this stuff that I wrote about the book, that happened Christmas Eve of 1944. So, but we still training all times. Some of the crews have been there and did that. They kept us out, you know, and what we should have looked forward to, you know, prepared us for the mission, you know.
Were you a little anxious before your first mission?
You know, I wasn't. We went to Ham. Ham, Germany, that was the shortest mission over there, and I guess they did that on purpose. But, of course, we didn't have enough sense to be scared, you know. But we finally picked it up, you know, that it was dangerous. Everybody had fright. But one of the things that helped us most was those 16 months that I spent in the regular Army.
Mm-hmm.
When we were trained, like they made men out of boys, so to speak, you know. We'd go on marches and march all night long and then rest, and several times the rain would be pouring down. And we'd lay down on the ground, and the rain wouldn't even bother us. We'd sleep 30, 40 minutes, and up going again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. And then went to Louisiana for maneuvers, and it's the same old story. You lay there in a pup tent, and then it rained that night, and you'd have water marks on your legs. But, you know, things like that toughens you up, and you learn to give and take, you know, and say, well, this is going to happen. Yeah, but do this. So It really did help, because I could tell some of the younger people that didn't do that, went directly into the Air Force.
So it sounds like you're saying that time in the Army helped you understand that you could handle and endure more than you maybe thought.
You're still frightened, scared, of course, especially on different situations. But overall, it really helped. It sure did.
And I guess another thought that comes to mind, if you hadn't volunteered for aviation cadet training, you might have been one of those guys on the ground at the Battle of the Bulge.
Incidentally, they were. The second engineers was one that the Germans was running over. The fog was so heavy that even they didn't know what they were hitting.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the guys said that we lost some of the people that I soldiered with. The tanks would run over them. Because, like I say, the Germans couldn't. It was a mess, The book will tell about that, but that's actually what it was.
So you don't have to speculate or wonder. You know where your unit was and what happened to them.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old Ralph Graham of Waco, Texas, including details from that Christmas Eve mission in 1944. While those beleaguered troops on the ground in the Battle of the Bulge finally had air support, there were airmen who gave their lives for our country that day, including General Frederick Castle. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with today's guest, Ralph Graham, as well as a link to his book, 12 Minutes. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.